Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
With your host, Andrew Donaldson, this is Herd Tell.
Welcome back to Herd Tell. We're so excited to get Eric Garcia back on. He is a congressional reporter for The Independent. He's also a metalhead. We'll get right into that in just a second because Gojira was the best part of the Olympics thus far. Yes. He's also an author. We'll talk about that in a little bit. One book in the pipe, one that's already been out for a while, been doing great. Eric, how are you, sir? Great to see you.
Doing all right. Good to be back.
Fantastic to see you. Let's just get to the Olympic controversy. I think the Les Mis push into a decapitated Marie Antoinette pull-out shot to Gojira on the prison wall was one of the best things I've seen in decades. What'd you think? That was so much fun.
That was incredible. I was a huge fan of it. I mean, I was like, when I saw Gojira, I was like, oh, of course. Like, I forget, like, because like I listened to Gojira when I was a teenager. I was like, oh yeah, they're like a huge global phenomenon now. It was very incredibly French and incredibly metal in the best ways possible.
Yeah, and it's the kind of metal I like. They do a little bit of scream stuff, but I love the power groove kind of metal, and
yes,
that's exactly what they played. And they had a little bit of the theatrics to go with it. And I love the genre so much that I really loved it being on that stage with that much of an appeal to it. And listening to Kelly Clarkson lose her little ever-loving mind on it on the American feed was even funnier. But then I went back, and I think you posted it, the French feed, they were so excited they kept talking over it.
Yeah, they were enthusiastic. They kept on just commentating over it. And I was just like, let them play.
Yeah, we're both metalheads, so that's the fun stuff. All right, let's get to the not fun part. You cover Congress. That is your bailiwick. It has been vastly underreported because everybody's been so busy with the Harris-Kamala Harris tag team out thing and the switch in the presidential election. Congress, the House of Representatives basically pulled up stakes and quit for the rest of the summer. And I know everybody's like, oh, because if you got school kids, August is the end of summer because your kids go back to school. But the August recess is kind of a tradition with Congress.
Yes.
But things don't happen in a vacuum. They happen in a sequence. And the sequence that happened, and it didn't get covered a lot because it was right when the Trump assassination, the J.D. Vance news hit, and all that happened. They had three votes fail spectacularly badly. And then when they came back, did a procedural vote, and went to the House. And other than the Netanyahu thing, they're done until basically September. This is a shocking story when you really think about it, and it's not really getting covered.
It's not getting covered, and it goes to the point. I mean, this is kind of the classic story of the House Republicans, the House Republican majority. They basically loaded up all the appropriations bills with right-wing priorities. And ironically, Brendan Buck talked about this, Paul Ryan's former guy, Paul Ryan and John Boehner's former guy. They Republicans have tried to do a partisan appropriations process, knowing it's not going to pass, knowing that it's going to anger a lot of people. And ironically, it's going to do the very thing that they say they don't want to do, which is almost going to guarantee an omnibus at the end of the year. So ironically, but this is what happens when you give so much power to the chaos caucus, the Joker caucus, whatever you want to call the critters over there.
Yeah, and it's even more than that, because what's really happened is they're just openly admitting, they're like, look, they had the 12 appropriation bills. They got like four of them through, seven of them are in committee waiting for when they come back. They know they're not going to get out. The ones they've already passed are not going to get through the Senate. So they're just openly saying, when we come back, we're basically going to do a CR and peace out for the election. That's the plan they're openly talking about. This isn't like machinations. This isn't deep reporting. No. They're saying this, we're coming back, we're doing a CR, and that's going to be it for this entire Congress. That's amazing to me.
The irony is that this is what the Tea Partiers and all them, the Tea Partiers and then the Freedom Caucus and all the rest of the folks and all the different mutations afterward have said, we don't like this process. We don't like the CR process. But as you and I know, the thing about, as much as these folks complain about the lack of an open process, the lack of regular order, that would require these dudes to actually, and it's mostly dudes, that would require these dudes to actually do some work. That would require them to actually sit in committee, work with Democrats. I mean, Kay Granger stepped down at the end of last year, so Tom Cole would need to actually work with Democrats, work with the Senate, correspond and coordinate. That is not fun. If you, it's less fun than going on Fox News or going on Rumble and pontificating.
Yeah, and Chip Roy, to his credit, although he wants it both ways all the times on all things,
he always does.
He even came out and he was self-serving saying it, but he wasn't wrong. He was saying it openly on the floor of the House, going, "Name me one thing, either side, come down to this microphone and tell me what I'm supposed to go back and run on." Now he's running in a safe district, so it doesn't matter because all he has to do is the buzzwords. But credit where it's due, he ain't wrong. And one of the things with the switch, and we'll get into the Harris and Biden stuff later. One of the things with the switch, though, was a lot of that had to do with, can we save the House? Talk to that a little bit, because when you talk to the House and the Senate folks, look, the Democrats might be able to split. There's a couple scenarios where they might get the Senate, but it's very unlikely just because of the geography and Manchin and a couple other things. The House is very much in play, and especially now with the enthusiasm gap getting cleaned up, even if Trump wins, there's more paths for them to get the House than not. Talk about that aspect of this, because underneath it, if you listen, especially to the Chip Roys, the people that have a little bit of power, the Mike Johnsons, they're worried. They really do act like, not their words, not what they're saying, the way they're acting with the CR, with the lack of stuff, they're acting like people that think they got a good chance of losing here.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's important to remember that. So the day after the debate, the House had its flyout day. And you know this, flyout days are normally chaotic. But Democrats were almost in a daze after the day after the debate. They were, I think it's fair to say, they were terrified. And I mean, I think, and multiple other reports said this, basically they were going to Pelosi saying, "Mother, may I," create some distance with Biden, or even say Biden needs to go. There was, and then conversely, I think what was interesting was after that, there was a dynamic up until the debate. There was an assumption among House Republicans that, we might lose the House, but Trump's going to win. So things aren't going to be too terrible, and we're going to get a Republican Senate just because of Ohio and Montana and West Virginia. And if Trump wins all those, and all three Republican challengers win those, and then that's the ball game. So we're going to be okay. Afterward, particularly after the debate, but more so, I would say after Trump got shot, there was a feeling that we don't need to worry. We might be okay. These districts are going our way. This might all work out for us. Now, the vibe is, this is, you know, as one Democratic strategist said to me, this is not a data election. This is a vibes election. The vibes shifted last week. It was interesting. I was talking with one Democratic congressman, and he said, like, he opened up his phone on Monday, and it just, like, blew up with donations. This is a down-ballot effect, and you've seen Republicans try to pivot on how to attack Harris. And I think you saw reporting in Politico that said, like, Johnson said, cut this out with the DEI nonsense. We should focus on the border. We should focus on crime. But of course, you know, House Republicans can't help themselves. So, but you're right. The actions that they're doing, that they're waiting for a CR, and then they're going to try to do an Omni at the end of the year. This all indicates that they feel like this is not going to go their way. This is not going to break the way they want.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
Yeah, Eric Garcia, you just brought it up, so let me touch on it real quick. After the debate, I know we talked privately. A mutual friend of ours was at a watch party because Congress was out when the debate happened. Yes. A watch party in D.C., big name people, if I named them, in the room. You know, this is something that happens frequently at things like this because it's also slash fundraising, networking, et cetera.
It is.
They're like, I've never seen something go dead silent and people just slowly start walking out. That's the report I got from that. And that was one of the big names things. And you heard the same stuff.
Yes.
Talk about the flip from that. The Trump getting shot was another one of those is, oh God, we don't have anything to counter this, to the first week of the Harris stuff you saw around the Netanyahu stuff, because that's the last time everybody was in town. But just picking that because that's when everybody was there. You just said vibe election, the vibe shift in Congress. Just compare and contrast those a little bit, because we saw all the silliness of, well, Congressman X that you've never heard of is pressuring Biden. None of that stuff mattered. Pelosi kind of matters. The overall feel of the party kind of mattered. And now the vibe shift and the very quick, about 36-hour coalescing around Harris, who was a senator, so you know and are familiar with her from covering her.
Yeah.
That does matter. Talk about that contrast from that debate. And you just mentioned it. Just walk us through the change and how the Congress critters and the senators are dealing with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, like, the day – so the House was in the day after Biden stepped aside. And, you know, it was interesting, like, it was funny. The day after the convention in Milwaukee, the convention, I should say, was, you know this, this is the big difference in how, between Republicans and Democrats. Republicans like to fight out in the open, and they say, this is good for democracy, this is good for all of us, let's air it out, let's do it in the open. Democrats are like, look, let's hash this out in private, and then let's have a unified front out in front of everybody, and we'll be one big happy family. There was a unified, just really, there was excitement in Milwaukee. There was a feeling of, hey, we're not going to just win the White House. We're going to win the House. We're going to get the House. we might get a few Senate seats. We might not. We didn't expect we were going to get. Things are going to be okay. Things are going to, not only are they going to be okay, they're going to be good. And then I think there was also, you can't talk about it without talking about, I guess you could say that the underlying anger underlying a lot of this, that Trump was shot, even though, you know, Crooks was, you know, it's hard to pin him down politically. He was just really just, it seems like he was just a disturbed dude. There was definitely a riding high, and it was combined with the fact that Biden was collapsing, combined with the fact that Democrats were all saying, Biden needs to step aside, combined with the multiple reports that Pelosi was trying to shove Biden off stage left. There was this feeling of, hey, the Democrats are collapsing. We're looking good. We're all a unified front. We're going to work out. And then that Friday happens. And then I think, and you and I have said this, Brown and Tester said Biden needed to step aside right before Trump took the stage. But the real nail in the coffin, if you ask me, was Sherrod Brown saying Biden needed to go. That was Brown is a party man. Brown is a guy who does what the party says. He, you know, he's his own man in a lot of ways, but he's also like, he's a devoted, loyal Democrat. When that happened, I was like, that's it. He's done. That ring the bell. Because you couldn't, at that point, you could no longer just say, well, I got the CBC in my, the Congressional Black Caucus in my pocket. You could no longer just, that was becoming a weaker and weaker alibi. Then on Sunday, it was almost instantaneous. Biden puts out his letter. Within 30 minutes, he endorses Kamala Harris. And that, I think, with the big fear that Democrats had was twofold. So like, was threefold. When Biden collapsed at the debate, there was, I remember texting Democratic sources, they say, replace her with Harris. And they were like, we'll sort it out later. They knew Harris had big liabilities, but they're like, we'll sort it out later. Or some people were worried, but then some people were afraid, well, that would look like a coronation, so we don't want to do this. And then some people said, but an open convention would be just a mess. Like we can't do this. Biden stepping aside and endorsing Harris allowed them to get the best of both worlds, where they didn't say this was an official coronation, but they all kind of just got on the train. It was very similar, I would say, to after Biden won South Carolina, and you got the whole, you got the whole family behind on the train with Biden before Super Tuesday. It was very similar to that. And there was this feeling of, there was almost this sigh of relief from Democrats from every wing. You know, a lot of Democrats weren't happy with Netanyahu coming and basically getting a partisan address. But they were, even then, they kind of were like, you know, Netanyahu's getting Netanyahu, but we're fine. We're going to be okay.
Eric Garcia, congressional reporter for The Independent, author in his own right. Let's talk about a member of the Senate. J.D. Vance has been in the news because he is now the VP pick for Trump. I've laid my biases about J.D. Vance on the table. I love the individual for a lot, long before this. This is not a new stance for me. So no, I will admit up front, I've got bias for him. You've covered him in the Senate. The feel originally, and this is from people that are very much Trump supporters, was like, okay, this was a little arrogant because this is doubling down on what Trump just likes. This isn't, you know, going out because Trump's unhindered. Pence was forced upon Trump. Let's all be honest here. He actually tried to get rid of Pence after he picked him because he didn't like him. This was Trump getting to do whatever he wanted. He listened to his son and the Thiel, what I call the tech bro wing of the MAGA party. That's what happened here, and he got Vance. I don't think it adds a lot. I think it might actually hurt a little bit as much as a VP pick matters. But what's his rep in the building, in the Senate? He hasn't been there very long. He's a first-term senator. He's mostly known for ticking off Mitt Romney and just saying whatever the MAGA flavor of the day is. But what's his rep in the building from people who have dealt with him in the hallways and so forth?
Yeah, this was fascinating. So I wrote a piece last week about how, about the Democrats who worked with J.D. Vance. Initially, a lot of Democrats were kind of hopeful about working with J.D. because after the train derailment in East Palestine, Sherrod Brown and John Fetterman and Bob Casey got work with him and Josh Hawley. They thought, hey, this might be a chance for a bipartisan opportunity. Basically, didn't, you know, Fetterman all but accused Vance of screw of not whipping the votes to screw Brown, screw Sherrod Brown, Josh Hawley blamed it on McConnell and Republican leadership, but take that for what it is. But even, you know, Tim Kaine, he wanted to work on with Vance on legislation to eliminate copays for childbirth. And then that was put on ice, and Kaine was really disappointed. But more than that, the reputation for Vance has always been that he's Trump's eyes and ears in the Senate. During the whole Ukraine border bill thing, he was a very hard heck no or hell no on any kind of aid to Ukraine, he said the border bill was insufficient. There was very much this fear. Vance very much is part of, I guess you could say, and I talk about this on social media all the time, the houseification of the Senate. He's very much a part of those kind of hellraisers, along with folks like Josh Hawley and Tommy Tuberville, and Roger Marshall of Kansas to a lesser extent, who want to shrug off the niceties of the Senate and just bring the fight, more than just bring the fight to the Democrats, bring the fight to Republican leadership and really have kind of the confrontational relationship with McConnell that you see House Republicans have with House Republican leadership. So he's built a reputation, but it's not necessarily a good one or not necessarily a positive one, because he's kind of, look, let's be real. He's only been in the Senate for a year and a half before Trump picked him. And, you know, what's ironic is as much as he picks a fight with Mitch McConnell, McConnell had to spend like $28 million to save his hide in Ohio. He's really just kind of built a reputation as kind of an aggressive, sharp-elbowed kind of guy. Not somebody who really even advances much.
It's also that goes into his personality.
Yes.
And again, I've got bias for the guy, I don't stand him, but his rep, if you actually read the book instead of just the cliff notes of the book and what the book was there, where he openly talks about, it's like, yeah, my law professor told me I needed to write this if I was ever going to be anything other than just a law school grad. Like, he openly admits it.
Yeah.
He's exactly. A very calculating guy.
Yes.
He flip flops from our point of view because he was completely against Trump. Now he's for Trump. He's a tech bro. Now he wants to be this union hybrid, almost a national socialist kind of thing, ideologically wise. He actually does think this stuff through. He plans it through. And when you're talking about him, you know, the open beef with Romney, where Romney's just trashing him on the Senate floor, which you almost never see that.
Yeah,
that kind of stuff, though, when you pair it to what you just said about, no, he was a conduit to Trump the whole time. This is not just happening. This has been in the works for a while. I'm one of the ones that said, no, the pick's going to be J.D. Vance. I had a little bit of people I talked to about that, but a lot of it was just the circumstances of the events leading up. And one of them was what you're talking about. It's like, no, he's been plugged into the Trump inner circle since he got to the Senate. This is all part and parcel to the political. Let me, because I'm sure he loves his wife and children, so I don't want to just demean the man. His political personality, let me put it that way. This all lines up to the character of the guy and why a lot of people like me doesn't like him, care for him, and or trust him, because what you just said lines up. There's a through line if you look at that under all the noise, right?
Yes. Absolutely. You could cut through the noise. You could look at the through line from his time at Yale. You could cut through his time when he was in the Bay Area, when he was working at Mithril, and working for Peter Thiel. There is very much a through line. This is a guy who very much wants to gravitate toward power and wants to gravitate toward achievement and accomplishment, but for better or for worse has always kind of needed a host. he's always needed somebody who's kind of a mentor. You know, when he was at Yale, it was you know, basically his professors, it was people like Amy Chua. When he was in the Bay, it was Peter Thiel, and it was all, you know, it was the tech MAGA, the hardware side of MAGA, as I like to call it. And then now it's really the Trump wing, you know, and basically, you know, Tucker Carlson all but admitted that he basically tried to influence Trump when he spoke at the RNC. And there was a report in the New York Times that Tucker Carlson basically said, don't pick Marco Rubio because the CIA would assassinate you. There is very clearly, Vance came to the Senate specifically as a MAGA guy. You know, because there are other senators, make no mistake, who have MAGA flavoring. Eric Schmidt, Katie Britt is trying to straddle the line between the McConnell and the McConnell and MAGA. Roger Marshall is very much one of those guys who is very MAGA. But Vance explicitly was the Trump guy in the Senate, particularly because the other MAGA guys all flamed out. You know, your Dr. Oz's, your Blake Masters, you know, all those other folks.
And underneath that, Eric Garcia joining this, one of the reasons I've been on, like, this wasn't a great VP pick. Look, VP matters very little, but when you have a look, the last election was 44,000 for president. The one before that, the Trump one, was like 80-some thousand. That's who decided these things. So margin,
yes,
money's in the margin, Sam Walton said. He invented a story you might have heard of. He knew what he was talking about. The thing with Vance is, electorally, he underperformed Trump badly in Ohio. Very badly. Mitch McConnell had to dump something like $30 million of Senate money plus his own PAC money into that to save that thing. Once again, Mitch McConnell saving the Trump wing of the party, but we'll talk about that some other time. Vance is pitched as one thing. The performance tells us something else. His biography tells us something else. I have huge questions that the J.D. Vance tech, whatever, we don't have a good term for this yet. I'm calling it the tech bro MAGA. You called it the hard drive, the hardware wing of MAGA. That's pretty good. Yeah, that's a good one. Whatever that Peter Thiel, the guys that have just glubbed on because they are businessmen from the tech world that saw the businessman Trump, how he co-opted politics for more business and more power. I think that's a fair way to put it. Whatever you call that wing, J.D. Vance is the vanguard of it. He's not quite 40. They see him as the avatar of that, but I don't think that scales nationally.
It doesn't even scale in Ohio. You know, Mike DeWine won by double digits, almost by like 20 points, I think, in Ohio. The governor of Ohio, I should say. Vance won by 5 points against Tim Ryan.
In September, not to interrupt you, but he was really in trouble in that race.
He was really in trouble, and that set up alarm bells. And because Rick Scott just didn't know how to run the NRSC, it required McConnell to say, fine, I'll do it myself, and just pour in millions of dollars. I think it was, like you said, it was something like $28 million combined with PAC money and all that. It wound up being something around more than $30 million. Just to drag Vance over the finish line and what should have been a layup. And this is important to remember. In the Ohio Republican primary, Vance was in some polls dead last among folks like Josh Mandel, who's the state treasurer, Matt Dolan, whose family helps run the runs the Cleveland Guardians. Trump picking Vance pole vaulted him to the front. But then the problem was Vance still had all the baggage that everybody was saying. So it required a caterpillar crane to get him across the finish line. And I think that what you're seeing now is that, you know, and other people have talked about this, Trump and Chris LaCivita and Susie Wiles, his campaign managers, basically were expecting a Trump landslide. So their whole feeling was, all right, let's just, you said it earlier, Pence was needed to solidify. Trump didn't win regular churchgoers in the 2016 primary. He needed a Mike Pence. Now he's got the evangelicals in his pocket. This was a we ball. We're doing things on our terms. We're doing it. We're doing what we want. We don't feel a need to grow the tent because people are just going to vote for us anyway. Joe Biden is historically unpopular. This was not like picking, you know, for a while people were saying that Trump was going to pick a woman. Then, you know, we all know what happened with Kristi Noem. He was never going to pick Nikki Haley. But even someone like the goal of a running mate is to do no harm. I think Doug Burgum would have been that way. I think even Rubio would have been that way. This is, you know, now we got story after story about J.D. Vance and childless cat ladies. So,
thank you for going with the cat lady one and not the other internet meme going on right now. We want to keep this a family-friendly show.
I'm staying away from that.
He's screwed over Appalachia. That's enough for me. I don't need to know what else he does in his private time. Eric Garcia with us. Let's go to the other side now. Former Senator, current sitting Vice President Kamala Harris. Here's my state of the race. You tell me what you're hearing from the people you talk to.
Go ahead.
I'm not going to look at a single poll until about 2 weeks after the DNC because we've got the euphoria, however you say that word, if I'd actually finished college on time instead of waiting and doing it online. Euphoria of the switch. That's boosted everything. You have the fundraising money, which was that was just a dam breaking where things have been held back and people got excited. Yeah. Trump's kind of spattered and sputtered trying to figure out how to readjust to it. You have the Vance stuff. She's going to get another bump around the DNC, and then I think about a week after that, we'll know where we're actually at. However, here's where I think she is. I think the Harris campaign needs to act like they're behind because they are, because they still got to dig out of the hole that Biden gave them. They're back within the margin of errors in the seven key swing states, but she's still behind in almost all of them and tied in one. She did shore up some places like Minnesota that started looking like they were in trouble. Now it's back to where it traditionally is, 5 to 9 points, something like that. This has stabilized the race. People are excited because it went from doom to stabilize. I'm not sure if President Biden was healthy, if he was the Biden of the spring, if he was the Biden of 2020. I'm not sure the dynamics of this race really changed all that much until we get after the DNC. And it, because right now this isn't really Kamala Harris running for president yet. This is all the events around it, right?
Yes,
I think about
exactly.
2 weeks, I think about 2 weeks after the DNC, you're going to have, because most people still have it. I've said this about candidates on the stage, like most people still haven't heard her talk, or they haven't heard her talk since 2019 and they just don't pay attention. They haven't seen when she has to campaign on her own 2 feet, then we will see somewhere around the end of August, 1st of September. Is that a fair way to lay all this out, do you think?
It absolutely is. You know, it's important to remember that Harris's campaign in 2019, she basically dropped out because she ran out of money. They had the momentum after the first debate against Biden, which took that swipe at him, and they never really figured out how to capitalize on it. You're right that right now there's this excitement because Harris is new, because it's no longer going to be a Trump-Biden rematch, which nobody wanted. 63% of Democrats wanted a different nominee than Joe Biden. There's a reason double haters was the buzzword of the past, 8 months. Now there is this, so Harris is benefiting from just, you know, this. She's got, you know, what George H.W. Bush used to call the big mo. The question, though, as he said now, is how is you know, and I talked with a few Democratic strategists, we're 99 days out from the election. She has to stick the landing on everything. This is not, ironically, this is going to be very similar to the UK elections where you have like 6 weeks of elections. She has to get the perfect VP nominee. She has to have a convention that goes off without a hitch. I do think that she and Trump are going to face off in a debate or two. I do think so. She has to do well in the debates. No room for error. She has to, I think, articulate and present herself in a way, because the two impressions people have of her are her 2019 campaign flaming out, and the almost Selena Meyer Veep-ish kind of impression people have of her as vice president, because in some ways the Biden White House didn't do her much favors, but also she didn't do herself much favors. Now she has the chance to reintroduce herself. And look, candidates reintroduce themselves all the time. You know, Ronald Reagan ran in 1976. You know, he wasn't the candidate at the time. He becomes the candidate in 1980. George H.W. Bush. Don't forget, Dukakis was beating Bush by double digits after the convention. And then the debates happen. So reintroducing candidates happens all the time.
And but the tank. Harris,
yeah,
which
yeah,
was unfair, and but it is what it is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They were literally measuring the drapes. You know. They're, so she has the opportunity to present herself. The question is, I think she's benefiting from the fact that Republicans haven't figured out the message. But once they figure out the message, and it looks like they're going to hit her on the border and cry, she has to have the momentum, have the answers to that question, have a good enough attack dog of a running mate, have enough of a campaign apparatus. Look, the money is great. The volunteer signups are fantastic. I would argue that's more important than the money. But what the actual infrastructure, because she's basically inherited Biden's campaign infrastructure. Well, how she retools the infrastructure and what she does with it is going to be essential in the coming weeks, especially after the convention when she gets a bump. But whether that's, you know, once that sugar high fades.
Yeah, and the Eric Garcia joining us. The Biden campaign-wise, infrastructure-wise, is an excellent campaign. I'm just talking nuts and bolts here, folks.
Yes.
They didn't have any messaging to work with.
Yeah, and a bad candidate.
One thing I've said in my writing and commentary on this is like, well, the big failure in 2019 for Harris was she could never answer the question of why she was running for president. Remember, yes. She had all the Hillary people behind her. She had the establishment behind her. It just didn't work.
Yes.
She's got that handed to her now. She's running for president to be not Trump, but she's got the same problem Biden has had for the last 2 years. Not Trump's not enough, because we're in season 9 of the Trump show and people just aren't scared of it. And I know the Democrats keep going, well, it's feared. You've heard into democracy for 10 years. It's just numb. People aren't listening. That's not going to work.
Correct.
They are fairly, in my opinion, vulnerable on the border because it's horrible optics and bad policy, although both parties are bad on the policy of it. But if you're in the chair, you get the blame. That's how it works. They are vulnerable on that. Can she come up with a message besides just not Trump? And I don't know. Look, the economy could tick up all of a sudden. That would help her. Maybe something foreign policy wise, although people just aren't interested in that right now. And the world's kind of a mess. I don't know what's out there as an overriding message other than not Trump, because I think not Trump gets her close and she ends up losing about where Trump won in 2016. And that's going to be the Electoral College unless she comes up with some kind of overriding message.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're seeing it a little bit with what she's saying with this message of freedom. You're seeing her going heavily into Dobbs. I mean, one of the things that, she was really the kid, you know, let's be real. Joe Biden was never comfortable talking about abortion because he's an 81-year-old white Catholic dude. I think that Harris is going to probably dig more into that. I think she's going to probably dig more into, she was the deciding vote on things like the ARP, saving the economy from COVID. I think she's going to probably dig more into the climate stuff, you know, signing on the IRA. The thing, I'll actually say this, The thing that I noticed when I was in about a month before the debate, I was in South Philadelphia. So this was the black area of Philadelphia. As Biden and Harris launched their Black Voters for Biden Harris thing, she got some of the biggest applause lines. And again, this is Black voters, so just take this for what it is. But you need, if you're a Democrat, you need to get just juiced Black voters to win. She got some of the biggest applause lines when she talked about the insulin cap. She got some of the biggest applause lines when she talked about criminal justice. She got a lot of the biggest applause lines when she talked about the economy. And I think those are going to be the main talking points that they're going to say. Obviously Dobbs is going to be the big thing. That's the thing that's been the secret sauce for Democrats ever since 2022. But I think that you're going to see her build out more, especially on the insulin stuff, especially on the economy, especially on low unemployment. You're seeing polling saying the voters trust her more on inflation. Those are going to be the main things that she's going to run on. The fact that crime is going down, I think, is going to be the other thing that you're going to see, is that she's going to say that, like, look, crime went down from the pandemic, and I'm going to take on the prosecutor who takes on Trump. There is going to be this kind of I think you're seeing the bits and pieces from the things that I've covered from her. How she puts that together in a message and in a coherent argument, I think is TBD at this moment, but you're seeing the parts come together.
Yeah, Eric Garcia with us. I know it's a vibe election, but my thing with a candidate is always, what's their coalition? That's why I never bought Nikki Haley. Nobody could ever. So, I'm on year like 10 of somebody trying to explain to me what Nikki Haley's coalition was going to be. They never could. Thus is thus. Kamala Harris. You just mentioned it with the Philadelphia rally. We talked to our buddy Donnell Suggs about it when the Morehouse thing happened and Biden went down there. And of course, he's the editor of the black newspaper, the Atlanta Voice. We talked about it with him, like, look, Democrats don't win just because of the black vote, but they can't win without it. That's got to be a 90% plus number for a Democrat to win nationally. It just has to be. And Biden had a historic number with it, and he won. That was in danger of not happening. We now have a little, again, polling's not going to be, but some of the specific polling has got some validity to it. She shored up the black vote. She stopped the bleed of the Hispanic vote, at least for the moment. And again, there's another one. The black vote's got to be over 90. Hispanics, 20 to 25 is the magic number. If Republicans get over 25, then you're in trouble. If they're under 25, you're doing okay. She's shored that up. What's her coalition going to look like? Because when I look at this objectively, Trump has always been electorally vulnerable to women all across the board, all stripes, all everything. He doesn't do well with women of all types of demographics. The question is, can Harris pull white men? That's the election. What does her coalition work like? And can she put a coalition together to answer those two questions? Because if she can pull women and get some men, now you got a winning coalition. If she doesn't do it, she ain't going to win. Is that pretty much where we're at?
That is absolutely where we're at. Amy Walter pointed this out last week. Amy Walter, the head of the Cook Political Report, who's a friend of mine. She said that, like, people forget, you know, because, like, Harris in 2019, she talked a lot about the Obama coalition. You know this and I know this. Oh, yes, Obama got a lot of young people, a lot of Latinos, a lot of black people, but he did cracked numbers with white men and rural whites. The perfect example of this is Wisconsin. He won Wisconsin by almost 14 points in 2008. And in 2012, he won Wisconsin by, I think, 7. So you're right that Harris is going to probably get gassed numbers with college-educated white women. She's going to get gas numbers with black women, probably a large amount of Latinas. The question is, like you said, she's got to juice, you know, Biden did, because Biden was an old white man, he did better with non-college-educated white men. Harris has to make up that difference with college-educated white men. She needs to get those numbers out, and she needs to put points on the board, because she's probably not going to get the same number that Biden did. She's also not going to have the same number that Biden did with seniors and with older voters. So she's going to have to make up those numbers elsewhere. So I think she's going to have to make it up with college-educated white men. Whether that's enough is anyone's guess. I think she's also going to have to do it with young men. That there was an interesting article this morning in the Wall Street Journal about how Gen Z men are leaning toward Trump, and Gen Z women are leaning toward Harris. So But she has to figure out, now that the world Democrat is almost, the world white Democrat is almost extinct, she has to make up that missing part of the Obama coalition.
And is there anything? Because so much of Obama, look, people don't want to hear this, but Obama was a personality. He was a charismatic figure. You can't replicate coalitions that are based on a charismatic, generational political figure like an Obama. George H.W. Bush found this out when he was trying to run as a third and fourth term of Reagan. It just doesn't work when you get the new hot freshness show up in Bill Clinton, even though he was probably the most qualified man to be president in the modern era because he'd held every job in government.
Yes.
Look, we talked about the hardcore numbers and the analytics. Now we're back to the vibe election. I know people kind of go like, well, it can't be both. But yeah, it is both because the average voter, whatever that is, they're not paying attention to the analytics like you and I do to explain a coalition. They're voting on vibes. I'll give J.D. Vance this. When Trump picked J.D. Vance, the first thing I thought about was, oh, he picked him for the debate with Kamala Harris because that's a bad matchup for her. You know, football, basketball, boxing, it doesn't matter how great you individually are. If it's a bad matchup, you're going to struggle. You know, bad teams play great teams great when they're division opponents because they know them, right? It's that sort of thing. Michigan can clip Ohio State even if they're having a bad year, right? It's a rivalry game, that sort of thing. I thought J.D. Vance was a horrible matchup for her because she doesn't have the personality and or the orating style to deal with just the absolute gish gallop that Vance was going to dump on her.
Yes.
I do think her matching up with Trump in a debate is a whole different beast because the disciplined Trump that stayed out of Biden's way, I don't think he can do that with Harris. He's going to want to get dirty. He's going to want to get mean because it worked with Hillary. But Hillary was much more unpopular than Harris is. Harris is younger. Harris is a new, fresh name to a lot. I know she's been vice president. I know she ran. But to most of America, she's still an unknown. Everybody knew Hillary. Hillary's unfavorable. So he got away with it with Hillary. If he goes hard after her on TV, we just talked about the whims of it. That 2-3% that we're worried that she can't make up with a coalition, Trump going overboard attacking her, Trump making it overly personal, Trump making strategic mistakes like not being disciplined, that's where that can also go her way, I think. And I think a debate with Trump has a real trap with it when it comes to VP Harris.
It absolutely does have a trap. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I noticed and I said to a lot of people, and a lot of people laughed at me, was that Trump was incredibly disciplined in letting Biden make his own mistakes and basically seal his own fate. Yeah, Trump would say a lot of nonsensical stuff at his rallies, but really, and I give credit to his campaign, which was incredibly disciplined. They really just let Joe Biden talk and let the results speak for themselves. Now they're going to have to actually run a campaign and actually campaign against Harris. And the perils of it, if he goes too hard on her, if you remember the town hall in 2016 where he was basically stalking her like a Clinton, like a lion, if that comes out, one of the things that just sheer physicality, like I've talked to Kamala Harris multiple times. I grew up in California. The first time I ever voted was when she was on the ballot in 2010. Like, so I've known Kamala Harris for a while. Kamala Harris is like 5'2". And the optics of a very large Donald Trump stalking and falling around and lumbering around Harris is not a good look. And I think that will be the thing that Harris's campaign should bet on and find a way to respond to it. Because I think that, I do think that Harris and Pence went match for match. I actually said for a long time, and you know this, and you actually agree with me. Pence is a good debater. Pence is a really good debater. He's very disciplined. I think that that when it comes to Trump and Harris, because Trump doesn't have discipline, it's going to be very difficult for him. He was very disciplined against Biden. I don't think he's going to be disciplined against Harris. Whoever Harris picks needs to have that same kind of discipline. And it has to be willing to ride out the J.D. Vance gish galloping and then be able to have a good response.
too, with VP Harris, we got to remember something else, and this hadn't been talked about. And again, Trump's the favorite right now. This is Trump's race to lose. So I know we're talking a lot about the Democrats, but this is Trump's race to lose. Trump's not the 2016 Trump. I don't think he can stalk a stage like he did then with the personality and the physicality he did then. I think one thing the Republican Party is discounting now is, and I think the Democrats are smart about this, the age thing really has flipped to how old Trump is, because you didn't talk about how old Trump was as long as Biden's in the race. Now that Biden's out of the race, this is a real thing they're going to have to come up with an answer for, because Trump's going to be 82, pushing 83 by the end of this lame duck term himself. Now you're back to the Biden argument. So they, in a way, they've spent a couple of years building up an argument that's now getting going to get flipped right back on them. If he, and I know that his thing's always energy, but it ain't the same guy. It's just not.
It isn't.
I still think he's probably the favorite to win, but if he had the chance of him having a dud performance at a debate because he just doesn't have the energy, or he does it, he doesn't contrast as well if she comes out high energy. I think that's there. I know a lot of the MAGA folks don't want to hear that, but that's a thing. He's not the 2016 Trump anymore.
That was something that you would hear from Republicans on other primary campaigns, you know, in 2024, in the early part of this year, and in 2023, that they would say, look, Ken Cuccinelli told me the same thing. Ken Cuccinelli worked for Trump. And he worked for the super PAC back to Santos. He's like, yeah, Trump has skipped a step. He's slower. And look, I've covered Trump. I've been to God knows how many Trump rallies. I've covered God knows how many Trump speeches. Yeah, he isn't the same guy. Look, I mean, when I was at the RNC, he went long for that speech. It went into midnight, and he went off prompter multiple times, and people were losing interest. And these were his guys, so. You know, is he skipping a step? Yeah, he skipped a step. Yeah, he's a lot slower. Look, he's been doing this for 9 years now. And also just like, you know, Father Time is undefeated, as McConnell likes to say. He has lost a step. So if Harris comes out, and you know, the irony is you know, Harris is 60, and she's going to be 60 later this year, is that like, if she just shows bigger strength, and if she just comes out showing you, then she might be able to crack this. She might be able to put up a fighting chance. Again, all the indicators show that this is still Trump's race to lose, but he can't have a bad performance against Harris. And also, I think him pulling out of debates is a non-starter.
He's got a debate. I know this was a political tool because they want to renegotiate, because they want to change. People don't want to look. What they were doing was actually smart. They negotiated a debate with Biden. Yes. They pulled it out because they want to change the terms of the debate when it comes to Harris, because they were trying to set it up to try to make Biden do certain things. They're going to want Harris to do certain things. That's smart. That's just politics. I'm not worried about that.
That's fine.
If he doesn't debate her, though, I think it hurts her. I think he wants to. He's arrogant. He'll do it. Let's go to the VP pick real quick, because somebody's going to have to sit across the table from Vance, and I just want to get to this briefly. As we record this, we don't know who the pick is. I think we'll probably get it at the end of this week, first of next week, because they're going to want that before they go to the DNC.
Yes.
I think she really wants Mark Kelly because they're friends. I think the party's going to dissuade her from that because Kelly's got that seat for life if he wants it, and that's a competitive state. So I think the party – and he's one of their best ATMs fundraising-wise. Nobody ever talks about that except you and me, but he's fantastic. A minority Democratic Senate needs Mark Kelly in it. That's just so the party's going to try to get her off that one, but she may win it out anyway because they're desperate and they don't have any leverage. Somebody you're real familiar with, you're a UNC guy, somebody like a Roy Cooper. A term-limited governor, that would be a good pick. Wirtz up in Minnesota, he looks like a good pick. It's got to be somebody vetted. It's got to be somebody that's won multiple elections, somebody they don't have to worry about. They got to get him in there quick. Does she go governor? Does she go senator? Does she just YOLO and go, let's really crank up the youth thing and just put Pete in there? Although nobody really thinks he's ready, but he's good on TV. And if you're going to do the youth thing, why? I'm actually kind of rooting for that one because I want the content of it, because I get paid for content. So
yeah, but yeah.
Does she just YOLO with Pete? What do you think? What are you hearing?
So one of the things that I've always noticed about Kamala Harris, I mean, going back to when I covered her Senate race in 2015 when I was working at National Journal, is she is – one thing that she shares with Barack Obama is she's a very cautious politician. She doesn't take risks. I think that her instincts would tell her, like you said, to pick a Mark Kelly, but I think that Chuck Schumer would put the kibosh on that immediately if he has his druthers. Just because, as you said, he is perfect for that state. Kelly, I think, put himself more in the running when he came out in support of the PRO Act last week. I think that Shapiro, you know, they were campaigning with her this weekend. Shapiro has, the main downside is that Harris has locked support from labor, and Shapiro would immediately get questions on school vouchers. Also, there's the fact that Shapiro, yes, he's won multiple AG races, but he's only 2 years in as governor. He doesn't have the vetting yet. Everybody mentions the Israel-Palestine thing. I don't think it's going to be as big of an issue. You know, at the end of the day, the president makes policy. I think that if you're talking about do no harm, Cooper and Beshear would be, I think, the prime picks. I think Walz has raised the stock. He raised his stock mostly because he's been the guy who's been talking about how these folks are weird. But the ultimate thing that the one downside that he's going to have, and I was talking with a friend of mine about this who knows Minnesota politics, is that like he's going to have to face questions about Minneapolis in 2020 after George Floyd. That's going to be the main thing that they hit him on. And then also the fact that he went from being a pro-gun rural Democrat to being, you know, a very progressive governor. I still think as of right now, Harris would pick, she would want to pick someone like Kelly, or she would want to pick, if she's feeling like, okay, balance the ticket, win the West, she goes for Kelly. But if she's thinking about a governing partner, her and Cooper have known each other for a decade, more than a decade. I think that Cooper is the ultimate do no harm candidate.
Cooper, who I'm very familiar with, I've had a home in North Carolina on and off for 20 years. I've always said he's boring, non-horny Clinton. He's been dealing with a supermajority. Well, it's slightly less than a supermajority now, but mostly a supermajority in his legislature. He's had Mark Robinson as his lieutenant governor for the last few years. He's used to dealing with nuts, crazy people. He can handle all that. He doesn't really misstep, but he's really smart on the triangulation stuff. And that's a dirty word nowadays. He has become the master of let the Republicans pass stuff and him take the credit for it. That's why I call him boring Clinton, because people forget Clinton got all the press, but Clinton was smart enough. He let Newt Gingrich do all this stuff legislatively, and then he just took the credit for it. That's what Cooper did. It's not going to be an exciting pick to a lot of people, but it would be a safe pick. It would be somebody, again, they know each other from the AG days. That's why they have that relationship. I think you're right. The only wild card here, I think, is if they really get pressure of like, all right, we need to win the TV show. Let's go, Pete. But I don't think Pete's ready. I know he's great on TV, guys. But here's the thing about VP picks, and we'll wrap up with this, because the J.D. Vance pick, and I said it when it came out, what a vice presidential pick is, it's really a demonstration of power for your faction within a political party. That's what the VP pick is. Evangelicals got Pence on the ticket because they needed somebody to make Trump safe. Biden got on with Obama because they needed to make the white folks feel safe. Let's call it what it is. That's why Biden's on that ticket. Hillary took Tim Kaine, same reason. He was dependable. He was, you know, just kind of, you know, milquetoast. Like he was generic Democrat if you looked up his name in the picture. This is a power faction kind of a move. This is going to tell us whether Harris has power in the party or if the party is going to dictate to her what faction, because this goes to that coalition thing we were talking about, this pick, what faction, what thing, what do you think if we look at it faction wise, who's got the stroke in the party to get this shoved through?
I think that Harris is, I think that at this point, you know, it was interesting. Kellyanne Conway was the person who floated Josh Shapiro for Harris to me. And I was just like, oh yeah, that makes sense. If Harris wants to do gas numbers in the suburbs and just juice up women turnout, she picks someone like a Josh Shapiro. She picks someone like a Mark Kelly who does numbers in the suburbs of Phoenix. If she wants to shore up with white men, I think that she picks someone like Walz or Cooper. And then to your point, if she wants to just do TV, YOLO, I have my reservations about how much Pete would do with the youth vote. Then she picks Pete just if you're going to run a TV-based campaign. I don't think that she does as well. He does as well with the youth as people think. But I think that it's all – but I think that if Schumer and Durbin – and look, she's a former senator. If they say, look, we need Mark in the Senate, if they have enough weight, they're going to keep Mark in the Senate. If she has power, she can say, look, I'm going to pick Mark Kelly, you know, and Katie Hobbs is a Democratic governor. She'll pick somebody else. We'll be fine. You know, but if she really is just thinking, look, we got to shore up older voters. We got to shore up white folks. And we want to make a play for North Carolina. And we might want to win Georgia. You pick Cooper. And if you want to do the suburbs, and if you want to do the Philly suburbs, you know, then you pick Shapiro.
I'm telling you, Robinson's going to drag that North Carolina ticket. I'm telling you, everybody thinks I'm crazy. I'm telling
you. No, you're right.
I'm talking to people. I'm here. I'm telling you that doesn't mean he ain't going to be the next governor, because Stein's not exactly exciting anybody. Look, Mark Robinson may still win, but he's going to underperform, and he's going to drag that ticket.
Yes, absolutely. No, I've said this for a long time. Stein has his own downsides because he's from the suburbs of Charlotte. He's not the suburbs of Raleigh. He does not really friendly with the rural areas. He doesn't have that many connections with black voters. But yeah, Mark Robinson is going to be a drag on that ticket. And if you have I used to call him not horny Roy Cooper. I call him Sheriff Andy Taylor. If you have Sheriff Andy Taylor campaigning in the suburbs of in the Triangle and the Triad and in the suburbs of Charlotte, along with the suburbs of Philly and the suburbs of Atlanta, then you might get some pull.
Yeah, and North Carolina is changing fast because you got Brunswick County, which I think is the third fastest growing county in the whole country right now. It's insane. Yeah. Raleigh's going bluer by the second. It's an interesting state. All right, Eric Garcia went longer than we intended to, but that's because he's like an information sandwich. He shows up and you just keep eating and it goes on and on and on because he knows what he's talking about. We appreciate you greatly, buddy. Let folks know where they can keep up with you. You got a new book coming. We didn't get into it. You've been texting about how MAGA's got a young man problem going, but that's kind of dovetailing into what you're working on. Let folks know about the old book, the new book, where they can keep up with you.
Yeah, so I'm working on a book. It's about autism and manhood and masculinity and right-wing extremism. That's going to be coming out sometime in 2026. You can buy my first book, We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation, wherever you could buy books, support your local bookstores. You can find me over on social media, over on Twitter or X, whatever Elon's calling it these days. You can call Eric M. Garcia. Follow me on Threads at Eric M. Garcia 14. This is a fun time. I always love coming back on Hurtel. So.
Is there going to be a book event for this male autism book that involves a train? It kind of has to, right?
It has to. Yes, of course. We're going to do it at Union Station in Washington, D.C. So, yeah.
No, well, that I don't know if you want to gather there after last week. Maybe Tweetsie Railroad or something. Cass Scenic Railroad in West Virginia. That'd be a good one. We'll do
yes,
that.
Yes, exactly. We'll do that.
Fantastic. Eric Garcia, good friend, good information. I rely on him a lot of stuff. He makes me look smart. Now he's going to make you look smart. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
All the music on Hurtel is provided under a Creative Content license from MonsterCat.com.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.